Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, I'm Matt Chorley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. Coming up on today's episode, the good news is that Fiona Wilson polls very well on Labour's front bench. The bad news, she doesn't actually exist. We've got exclusive polling on how well known both the Cabinet and Shadow Cabinet are, and we'll get some tips on how to possibly raise your profile, Minister. Before that, in The Columnist, India Knight and James Marriott on Do We Care that Keir Starmer had a very good time when he was a student. And if you like what you hear on the podcast, join me for Politics Without the Boring Bits, live on Times Radio, for free on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. That's Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. Right, first, as we always do on the podcast on a Friday, let's take a look at what we learned this week. We learned that the Lib Dems have run out of puns for their stunts, so they did the time one again, although Ed Davey does now have an hourglass figure.
He might have bottled the general election, but time is running out for Rishi Sunak.
Do you see? We learned that Barack Obama popped in to offer some election-winning advice to Rishi Sunak.
You know, good luck with that.
We learned that Lindsay Hoyle should be worried.
Give us a cheer if you think Chorley MP Lindsay Hoyle should resign as Speaker. Oh, wow, I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah, that was people in his seat of Chorley. We learned that Keir Starmer's back doing the jokes.
I've prosecuted more people smugglers than he's had. Helicopter rides, and that's a lot.
Sorry, what rides?
Helicopter rides.
Helicopter rides. We learned from Jeremy Hunt when the election's going to be.
If the general election is in October, that will mean it's very, very tight.
Put that in your diaries. We learned from former police chief Lord Mackenzie of Framwell Gate that his other half has been a victim of crime.
My wife, on one of her rare visits to London, had a credit card stolen, and I monitored the use of the card. And I have to say, I didn't report it to the police because the thief was spending less than she was.
We learned from Danny Finkelstein the pitfalls of political celebrity endorsements.
The Conservative Party tried for its conference to get a bunch of celebrities, and it really struggled. We got Rick Wakeman from Yes. We got Mike Reed, the DJ, and Mike Yarwood, who was no longer on television. And then when the Labour Party conference came round, they had Nelson Mandela.
And finally, we learned from the latest YouGov poll that the Tories are now being led by Paul Hardcastle. 19. And that is what we learned this week. Now, time for these two.
The Columnists with Knight at the Marriott, India Knight and James Marriott.
I was hunched on my bedroom floor with my laptop frantically bashing away at my column.
And we say hello to India Knight. Hello, India Knight.
Hi, Matt.
Nice to see you. And James Marriott's here, pretty in pink.
Oh, thank you. Yes.
Splash of
adding
colour
a little
spring.
Prettiness to the office, as always.
It's the only way you can describe anyone as pretty in the office now is if you're describing yourself.
Yes.
If you did it to anyone else, you'd be HR'd under the eyebox in no time.
That's just bog standard columnist egotism, isn't it?
Tell you what, I am quite pretty. Now, here's a question, and I suspect listeners will have strong views on this. Does it matter if a politician took drugs when they were younger? Keir Starmer has been speaking to the Sun's political editor, Harry Cole, on their news show, Never Mind the Ballots, and faced some tough, and it was almost Paxman-esque this, it just went on and on and on, some tough questioning over whether he used drugs.
When did you last take illegal drugs?
Oh, Harry, I had a good time when I was a student.
What does a good time when you're a student look like?
It means I had a good time when I was a student.
But what does that mean?
It means I had a good time when
so
I was a
smoking
student.
Some spliffs, doing some acid, partying, drugs. What was it?
A good time.
You're not answering the question, are you?
I had a good time when I was a student.
Did you ever do drugs after you left university?
Look, I had a good time when I was a student, and whichever way you put this, Harry.
Did you do drugs when you were a lot?
Look, Harry, I'm not going down that road.
Now, of course, Keir Starmer's not the first politician to face questions about taking drugs.
I think politicians, like other people in life, are entitled to a private past that should remain private and in the past.
When I was in England, I experimented with marijuana a time or two and I didn't like it and didn't inhale and never tried it again.
David Cameron and Bill Clinton there. India, does this matter?
Whether people took drugs when they were a student? No, yeah. I don't think it does. I don't think it does. It would matter if they took drugs last night, but taking drugs decades ago when they were a student is absolutely fine. I mean, he's basically saying yes, isn't he? He's by repeating that he had a good time when he was a student, he's saying, yes, I did take drugs when I was a student, and I think that's absolutely fine, unless the drugs in question led to him being a methadone addict for 20 years. But I don't think that's the kind of area we're in. So no, I think it's completely fine, totally fine. But I wish they would just say yes.
Well, do you know what? Now, call me cynical. I wonder whether he didn't take drugs, but he's sort of sounding slightly more interested. Because I remember this in 2014, Ed Miliband was asked if he'd taken drugs. And he said no, but he had read about them. And I just wonder whether actually saying, I had a good time as a student, if you know what I mean. It's got a sort of...
I was actually reading a lot of legal textbooks.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
Law was my drug.
Which was... I was addicted to legal precedents. Do you think it matters, James?
No. Well, I think the only way it conceivably could matter is when these things become part of a narrative about somebody, and if it feeds into, you know, a dangerous sense that maybe a political leader is a bit too crazy and a bit too wild and a bit too unserious. I don't think any of those things are true for Keir Starmer. I don't think anyone's thinking, oh my God, I think Keir Starmer is like, you know, he was a bit fun, but I think he might be too fun with all these illegal drugs. I think a lot of people have your reaction, which is just kind of be like, did he really though? Like, really? And it's sort of, I think it's very safe. I think social mores in this have changed so much. And I think it probably was about 20 years ago, you know, maybe still might have mattered. But when you think about how, you know, especially things in America have changed, and the fact that, you know, marijuana has been kind of effectively decriminalized in a lot of parts of Britain, you know, the police won't make it a priority. I just think it doesn't matter in the same way that it did.
Well, it's interesting because I looked it up and I was surprised it was quite so long ago. It was in 2000, Anne Widdecombe was Shadow Home Secretary under William Hague. And she announced, I think at the Tory Party conference, a big crackdown on cannabis. And then she had to row back on it when it turned out 7 members of the shadow cabinet were on the record as having used it. And they had to walk it back. It's interesting. Lisa says, for goodness sake, it's 2024. Of course it doesn't matter. Who cares? Won't win or lose in votes. Might have made it more interesting if he had said yes. Mike says, I don't care if Keir took drugs. I'm still shocked at the fact he can walk away from a badly packed dishwasher. But then Alf says, it does matter. It's about obedience to the law. So, you know, there are maybe that is also a generational thing, and it will change. It's quite hard if he's going to go quite, sort of, you know, I was a fine upstanding director of public prosecution. It depends what the drugs are.
Yeah, and I think, it's also, I think maybe, you know, probably one of the older generations of voters has now came of age in the 60s.
Yeah.
And perhaps, you know, 20 years ago, you had an older generation of sort of pre-60s people to whom it seemed, you know, quite alarming and unusual. And, you know, people who were, you know, young in the 60s are much more accustomed to this, and therefore you've lost that constituency of people who would be really outraged by it. That might be what makes it safer.
And it's also interesting. Sorry, it's also interesting in the context of alcohol. Westminster, of course, is awash in alcohol, and of course, alcohol is legal. But I would be more concerned about somebody having a very heavy alcohol consumption now or in the past than I would about somebody getting up to whatever when they were a student.
But I suppose if, because in the past, you know, he's talked about a war on drugs. There's been a lot of talk in the sort of political conversation about particularly sort of middle class cocaine users, you know, thinking it's just an amusing thing to do at dinner, but ignoring the impact it might be having. So there is some risk there, I think, for him. I don't know. Maybe we'll see. Right, let's move on, because I want to talk about your column, James, and loneliness. So you've written your column about loneliness, and I was quite struck by the idea. Was it before the 17th? How far back do we have to go before you couldn't avoid
anyone? Before the end of the 17th century, basically nobody was ever left alone. It was very, very, very hard to spend any time by yourself in a way that I think is quite difficult for us to get our heads around. But people were just constantly in company. And I think I had a friend who went back to visit his family in Bangladesh, and he said he really noticed that whenever he tried to go for a walk by himself, everyone was like, what are you doing? Like, we'll come with you. And he was like, no, I want to go for a walk by myself. And like, his relatives would escort him out the house. And I think it's quite a Western thing to think that, you know,
me time.
We need me time. We should be alone. In a lot of other societies, and especially historically, that was basically impossible.
Yeah. And so this then aligned with one of my favourite stories of this week is the town of Witheridge, or Village, I think it is, where they found out the bells of their clock were going to be silenced because of one single noise complaint. So it's the bells of... These are just generic bells. The bells of St John the Baptist have been chiming in the Devon village for more than 150 years. But they were stopped by a noise abatement order, and it turned out only one person had complained. And it made me think of the same thing, this sort of culture of everything must suit me.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
All about me. And there's no rubbing along. You know, the point you make in your column, in the old days, you know, you couldn't get away from people. You just had to deal with other people,
and they might be a bit annoying, and they might get in your way, and they might ring their church bells a bit bloody loudly, but you sort of just deal with it, and that's fine. And ultimately, you'd probably be happier for dealing with it rather than trying to, you know, hive yourself off from the world and have everything your way. Yeah, I mean, that's such a depressing news story. It's really ridiculous.
What do you think, India? Should we all get used to rubbing along a bit more?
Yes, I think so. One of my favourite people is a woman called Esther Perel, who's a kind of sex therapist, but she's much better than that. And she wrote a very interesting book about monogamy and about marriage, in which one of her arguments is that we now... in relationships want the other person to be everything, to do every job, to be, you know, to be a lover, but also a friend, you know, your lover, your best friend, your rescuer, you're the person you go to with your troubles, et cetera, et cetera. And her point is that until reasonably recently, there used to be different people doing all those jobs. You know, you'd have your friend over there and your comforter over there and your confessor over there and your person. And that putting all your eggs in another person's basket is incredibly stressful, both for you and for the other person.
That's so interesting.
So, I think the more people, it's that thing about it takes a village, you know, I think the more people you can surround yourself with, the better and the less stressful in terms of your relationships.
And the whole idea of your friends, you know, having friends, particularly if you're in relationships and you get married and you get older and all that, so important to have friends who serve other purposes. That's the person I go and talk nonsense about, I don't know, whether it's football or music or hiking, not, you know, having that.
Yeah, it's kind of quite a cruel thing to put on one person to say you have to fulfil all these things for me.
Yeah,
you
it's
have to,
impossible.
You know, be able to talk to me
but
about
then
my
also
hobbies.
In some relationships, to be clear, not mine, you get one person who's like, you don't need your friend, you know, it becomes a sort of, what you're not going out with your friends, you don't need to go and see your friend, you know, we've got everything
now.
Yeah,
that's really bad.
Yeah.
You don't walk away from that one, yeah.
Like I said, it's not my relationship. My wife always very pleased if I go.
No, I wasn't saying you. From your wife.
Get out of the house. You sure you wouldn't like to step outside for a couple of hours?
I found you some new friends. Now, India, you'd picked out a story, which I confess this is sort of slightly passed me by. So this is, we talked a lot before about the rewriting of books in England, but it's happening in France now as well. The French culture minister has criticised the rewriting of works by Agatha Christie, Roald Dahl and other English-speaking publishers, saying it amounts to censorship.
Yeah, she says they're not going to do it at all. She's completely against it, and that books must be published in their original form using the exact language they were written in. And I think it's interesting because I don't quite know what I think about it. I think renaming one of Agatha Christie's best-known novels, as happened here, I think, gosh, a long time ago, maybe in the 80s, maybe even the late 70s, is not detrimental to the reading and the enjoyment of the book. And I think where the language is so glaringly at odds with current sensibilities, you know, like Roald Dahl and the Oompa Loompas, which there was a big hoo-ha about a few months ago, or last year sometime, the Oompa Loompas were originally written as very dark-skinned African pygmies who are transported by Willy Wonka in boxes with holes in so they can breathe to basically become his slaves. Now, making the Oompa Loompas fair-skinned, which he did, again, I think in the late 70s, after pressure from various organisations, doesn't materially change the purpose of the Oompa Loompas in the book. And, you know, it just doesn't make you kind of wince with horror when you read it. So I think that's fine, but I think it's a very thin line. And I'm against censorship generally. But I think this sort of light remodeling is not necessarily a disaster. But I'm not sure I do think that. I'm on the fence.
It's a weird one, isn't it? Because in some of the Roald Dahl cases, James, it was sort of, wasn't it like fat people? And, you know, where do you draw the line? If I don't know, a character, like in, is it The Great Escape or Dam Busters, the dog's got a...
The
N-word is the name of the dog. So, and you can change that. You change the name of the dog, doesn't change the story. It doesn't really matter to the grand scheme of things. But if you start sort of knocking all the edges off of all language, again, I suppose, you're saying, well, I want it all to suit my sensibilities.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think I'm probably a bit more free speechy than India on this. I agree that the stuff about Oompa Loompas obviously should have been changed and was changed a very long time ago, but this stuff has gone way too far recently. And it's not often you know, find yourself going, oh, thank God for the French, they're so sensible. But I think they are much more sensible about this. And I think it helps that they're not as exposed to America as we are, you know, because we speak English. We're just like in the middle of this American culture war with all these, you know, very puritanical American ideas about, you know, free speech and not censoring everything. And I think the French have always had a very useful, healthy skepticism, often hostility towards, like, you know, American Anglo-Saxon Puritanism. And I think, you know, it helps them a lot there. I mean, they're also much happier for their writers to be shocking and, you know, say be disgraceful, sometimes to, you know, slight extremes. But there's just a different culture there that, you know, I slightly wish we maybe had a bit more of, I think.
People should be able, I think you should be able to, when you're reading, sort of realise this is an Agatha Christie. It was written 100 years ago.
Yes, I mean, maybe
that's partly what's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Maybe you have a little thing at the front saying, you know, this reflects the opinions and the language of the time. Maybe that's the way around it. Maybe you leave it well alone and you just place it into context.
And actually,
very
if it is a book, you could always, you know, you could get someone to write a forward or something, you know, and say, you know, it's interesting to read it now. Obviously, we should bear in mind it was 100 years ago, you know, bring things in context rather than sort of trying to erase it and suggest it didn't happen.
Then who says in 50 years' time all the changes we're making now won't look equally absurd and silly and of their time and offensive and weird?
When we're all robots.
Yes, when we're all robots.
Now we're off to the theatre.
Every hospital in this country will be nationalised. I will build more hospitals. Better hospitals, where there is need rather than where there is money.
You want the doctors to be servants of the state.
You'll create the greatest healthcare crisis in the history of the country.
Every doctor.
That's Nye, the Nationals' acclaimed new play about Anuim Bevin. But is it any good? Is political theatre lacking bite? Clive Davis is the Times' chief theatre critic. Hi, Clive.
Hi, Matt.
What did you think of Nye?
Well, I was kind of in two minds about it. I recommended seeing it because Michael Sheen
plays Nye Bevan. And, you know, Michael Sheen is such a fine actor. So you should take any opportunity to see him. And he gives a terrific performance. The play itself, it's very, it's more like a pageant than a play. It's very bitty and it is quite simplistic in some ways in the way it treats the Tories. In its defense, I'd say the play, it's structured as a kind of dream. Nye Bevan's on his deathbed. So it's all looking at events through his eyes. So you can allow for a certain amount of bias because it's viewing life through Nye Bevan's eyes.
And it comes after you read the reason I want to talk to you because I read it in the theatre newsletter this week. You were saying that there was a feeling that maybe political theatre had lost its bite a bit. It's been a long time going back to This House, James Graham's This House, which is terrific, all about the whipping during the 1970s in the House of Commons, which actually was quite even-handed. It wasn't preachy. It wasn't the obvious London lovey's put on play, which says Tories are nasty.
Yeah, I think we have gone backwards since then. For lots of different reasons. We just seem to have a lot of playwrights at the moment who are really pushing I suppose you could call it a Corbynite line on politics in general, which is fine if you believe it, if you take that line, but it's just that everyone takes the same approach to the question of politics and they all become slightly simplistic and repetitive. And you end up just lecturing the audience, basically.
It's just boring, isn't it, James?
Yeah, it's incredibly dreary. And also, I don't know, yeah, I mean, the theatre should challenge you and it should, I think ultimately you should come out of the theatre thinking, everything's a bit more complex and interesting than I thought, rather than, oh yes, that's exactly what I thought, or, oh, I completely disagree with that, what a load of simplistic nonsense.
Yeah.
Yeah, it should, I don't know, yeah, it should be interesting and complicated.
A thought-provoker. Exactly. What do you think,
India? Yes, I completely agree. I also think there's the risk of insulting your audience. You know, if you're preaching at your audience and if your preaching is, as Clive says, reductive and simplistic, then the poor person who's forked out an inordinate amount of money to go and see the production is just going to feel kind of insulted when they leave if they hold different views. So I'm all for kind of, you know, really firebrandy, raging, incandescent theatre, but there's a difference between all of that and just somebody quite smugly telling you what you ought to think.
And often in those situations, they sort of leave out all the awkward bits which show...
All the inconvenient bits.
Yeah, which might have made it more interesting.
Which might have made it more interesting. And it's also because there's this play coming to the Old Vic called The Constituent. It's right up my street, this. James Corden and Anna Maxwell Martin, who's been in loads of stuff, probably best known for being in Line of Duty, been in absolutely loads of stuff. Motherland, she's in as well, as I think. Mm. And it's been written by Joe Pennell, and it centres on a conscientious backbencher MP trying to deal with James Corden, who's an ex-serviceman who's suffering a meltdown. And Pennell says he's become fascinated and appalled by the growing antipathy towards elected politicians. This couldn't be more up our street. But, Clive, how confident are you that it will tread that line properly, that it's not just going to be Labour backbencher going, no, I'd like to help, but it's the Tories?
Well, I'm keeping my fingers crossed. I mean, yeah. Joe Pennell wrote a fine play called Blue Orange about about a psychiatric hospital, which didn't bang on about Tories cutting the NHS and doing evil things. And it was genuinely thought-provoking. So I'm hoping that this will, you know, take a similar line. And, you know, there might be lots of people licking envelopes and that kind of thing and doing the kind of thing that people do in constituencies.
It's going to be a fine line to tread, though, Lyndia, because between capturing life in an MP's office and not boring the audience to tears. Because like you said, it's just somebody just putting file envelopes in the post and filing of those.
Well, maybe that's quite a good idea. I think some people are really, really unaware of, you know, the drudgery of it and of what goes on. So if it stops the crazier elements thinking that they just sort of swan around, you know, lying on velvet couches, scarfing oysters, then that's probably quite a good thing.
James,
yeah, I agree.
I have actually already bought tickets.
I mean, I kind of love this sort of thing.
I do like the sound of it.
The first time
yeah.
I ever went to the National Theatre, my dad took me to see a play called Never So Good, which is about Harold Macmillan. And I think it made me really interested in politics. And yeah, I was all for it.
Yeah, I took was like a young teenager, 13, 14, took her to see This House, thinking this, you know, this is a hard sell, but we'll see how we get on. Loved it because it told the story, you know, it brought the drama.
If you don't know much about politics, as you often don't when you're a kid, a play can be quite a good way at
Yeah.
Dramatising the issues and making it come alive and making you understand the history.
Well, me try to explain the whipping system over dinner.
you'll have your National Theatre play soon.
India Knight and James Marriott there and Clive Davis, and you can read them all in The Times and The Sunday Times with your subscription. Just go to thetimes.co.uk. And don't forget, with your subscription, we will be able to get the bonus episode of Politics About the Boring Bits when it lands this weekend. Up next, we take a look at the popularity of made-up ministers.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Big Thing.
Let's speak to the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, now.
Keir Starmer, really appreciate you popping in today. I know you've got a very busy day.
We're joined by Foreign Secretary James Cleverly.
Michael Gove, the Secretary of State for Levelling Up Housing and Communities, is here to tell us who's right.
David Cameron, welcome to Times Radio.
Now we're joined by the Shadow Health Secretary, Wes Streeting. Good morning.
Steve Barclay, good morning to you.
So, Angela Rayner.
Hello.
Welcome back to Times Radio.
The Tory frontbencher, Henry Thorpe, is my guest.
I'm joined now by Labour MP, Fiona Wilson.
Yeah, those were just some of the many ministers and shadow ministers you hear on Times Radio, your election station. Well, the good news for Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer is that polling for this programme shows that both parties have got some well-known and reasonably popular front bench spokespeople. The bad news is some of them don't exist. Fiona Wilson, as you heard there, Labour shadow minister Fiona Wilson, completely made up, better known and more popular than some of Keir Starmer's biggest media performers. The Tory minister, Henry Thorpe, also entirely fictional, better known than the Energy Secretary, Claire Coutinho. He's also the second most popular Tory frontbencher. Well, the polling was carried out by Gabriel Milland, partner at Portland Communications, former government advisor, used to do polling in number 10, and Gabriel's here. Morning, Gabriel.
Hi, Matt. Hi.
So, apart from being very funny, what is the purpose of this polling? What does it tell us overall?
I think it tells us several things. First off, is something that people inside the SW1 village should always, always remember, which is, although the general public are deeply wise, they know very, very little indeed about politics and take a very small interest in it. These are normal people. And the best way of doing that is I do a lot of polling, but I've also, in my career, done a lot of focus groups and as well. And there is nothing like sitting in a room full of tyre fitters in Stoke-on-Trent to make you realise that even though their instincts are usually absolutely bang on, the amount they actually know is pretty small.
So let's pick through some of the details of this with Times Radio senior political correspondent and Labour watcher Patrick McGuire. Patrick, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Matt.
And we've also got Salma Shah, former special advisor to Sajid Javid when he was Home Secretary. Well, in fact, lots of jobs. And now director at Kraken Strategy Limited. Hi, Salma.
Hello.
So, Patrick, first of all, take us through the numbers for Fiona Wilson. How does she measure up as a Labour frontbencher?
Well, she's known by 47%. Of voters. That's higher than Thangam Debonair, who's the Shadow Culture Secretary, and Nick Thomas Simmons, who's very well known in certain Oxford colleges and London bookshops, but the Shadow Cabinet Office Minister is not as well known as Fiona Wilson. She has a 15% net favourability rating. That's higher than Bridget Phillipson, the Shadow Education Secretary, Pat McFadden, who's been around for an awfully long time, he's the National Campaign Coordinator, and Johnny Reynolds, the Shadow Business Secretary, all three of whom are regular fixtures on the airwaves. She's particularly popular, unsurprisingly, among Labour voters, people who voted Labour in 2019, 27% of whom said they have a favourable opinion of her, 23% of Lib Dems do. Less good among people who voted Tory in 2019. I'm not sure she's doing much to win over those Tory switches. Only 6% of 2019 Tory voters say they have a favourable opinion of Fiona Wilson. More popular among men than women, interestingly. 17% of men say they have a favourable opinion of Fiona Wilson. Only 12% of women do. And she is a smash hit, I can tell you, Matt, among millennials. So 25 to 34-year-olds, some Gen Z in there as well. 23%, more than any other age group, say they have a favourable opinion of Fiona Wilson.
That's, I mean, it's all excellent news for Keir Starmer, with the one proviso that she doesn't exist. Salma, if I said to you, we'd put you on this morning and I said, you know, Henry Thorpe's doing quite well in this, he's, you know, he's got minus, he's, his net favourability is only minus 10, second only to Penny Mordaunt. How long would it be before you corrected me and pointed out that Henry Thorpe didn't exist?
I think I'd probably go, oh, do you think he's going to challenge Rishi for the leadership now because of his net favourability rating? Because even though, you know, I was around in Westminster for a long time and a lot of my business is focused on Westminster policy, actually keeping, even in that circumstance, keeping abreast of kind of who's there and who's up and who's down and who's in and who's out is actually quite difficult. So I think Gabriel's polling has really shone a light on that thing that the Westminster Village, as he just said, really misses, is that most people don't care about what they do. They care about what is done to them in Westminster. I just want to know when Henry Thorpe's going to throw his hat into the ring.
Henry Thorpe and Fiona Wilson are brilliant names, if you don't mind. Did you do a series of polling and focus groups before you got to the Tory?
I picked them out as being kind of typical names for the kind of person who becomes a Labour front buncher and the kind of person who becomes a Tory cabinet minister. I mean, this morning, me and a friend were kind of working up bios for them and working out where they'd gone to university, and we thought that Henry Thorpe might have done a short service commission in the Rifles and married to Tilly, you know, all of this sort of stuff. But to go back onto more serious stuff, I think one of the things that's very interesting about this as well is the low awareness that some people, that the electorate seems to have of some people in absolutely key jobs, yeah, not just on the Labour side, where you kind of expect that, but on the government side as well. So the number of people aware of Victoria Atkins, now health is a top three issue in the coming general election, we expect, is absolutely subterranean. I think it's in the low 40s or something like that.
And the other thing that struck me, when you look at like the polling for Henry Thorpe, he's on 10% of people are favourable towards him. Amongst currently people voting for the Conservatives, 19%. Clearly, what a lot of people are doing is that they're told that these people are in the government. What do you think of these people in the government? And they just say, well, I don't like the government. Yeah. And so it tells us that the view of the Tories overall is sort of infecting everything. That they're giving the thumbs down to someone who does... So fed up are they with the Tories that only 10% of people are favourable to a man who doesn't exist.
Yeah, exactly. And this was behind... I mean, you know, we stand on the shoulders of giants. This... I don't want to make any false claims for originality for this work. I mean, it's very similar to some really important work that was done during the William Hague times, for example, which tested certain policies and revealed that if you said that they were a Tory policy, the ratings for them were vastly worse than if you said that they were a government policy, a Blair policy at the time. I think this indicates the baggage, you know, that the Conservative Party has. And we're seeing that. I mean, obviously, we saw that most recently in the absolutely stonking YouGov poll yesterday morning at 19%. Crossover with Reform is getting closer and closer. There's one interesting other set of questions that we ran in this poll as well, which was, would it make much of a difference if Rishi Sunak were replaced? And that is not something that looks to be going that way at all.
So that's interesting. That so the clearly Tory MPs, for some reason, the last week, a lot of Tory MPs have said, we seem to be doing quite badly. But the idea that automatically leads to, well, if we change leader, that'll turn things around.
No.
those two, it is possible to think the first is true without thinking the second.
Absolutely. And, you know, as residents of the SW1 village, we just need to get less hang up on the personalities here. What outperforms all the issues, all the other issues, including personalities, including changing Prime Minister, is things like, would you be more likely to vote Conservative if there was a big drop in waiting lists, which comes top, if there was a big drop in inflation, if the economy looked better, all of those things, and also small boats as well. But the kind of the bread and butter, kitchen sink, kitchen table issues outperform boats even. The only group where they don't really outperform boats for the Tories is amongst people who say they're going to vote Reform, where it is the top issue. But NHS waiting list is pretty close. Yeah.
And Sam, I suppose the other thing, which it is hard for people when they're making this hypothetical prediction, but it's hard to model just what the public reaction would be to the Tories doing it all over again. Just the very, you know, regardless who the personality is and regardless of the merits of it, regardless of whether in the polls, just how funny it would look if the Tories had another new leader.
Yeah, I mean, this is the entire issue about what happens when you are in that bubble in Westminster, which is that people get very hung up on the personalities because they are in a very small environment talking to the same people over and over again and winding each other up. And if you took the outside perspective, you know, the question would be, well, does changing the leader change anything? Is it going to help waiting lists? And the answer is no. In fact, it's going to probably delay that and make that even tougher. I think Gabriel made a really interesting point about whether people recognise important cabinet ministers. And I think that is also a sort of a challenge that occurs in Westminster and because of that bubble thinking. How much exposure do you give individuals to get them out there and sell the message of what they're doing? And it's that closely controlled grid system that I think also sometimes stifles that perspective and makes everybody sort of run from this planning document at the centre of government, but not really respond to what's actually happening out there and how people are feeling about what they're seeing.
In fact, somebody tweeted the full league table, we'll come to the league table in a minute, and pointed out Mark Harper, the Transport Secretary, has terrible ratings, despite the fact that people are very concerned about transport. Part of the problem is, even when he is out and about, Mark Harper, he almost never talks about transport. He's just the guy put up on the media. He's just sort of interchangeable. It's true of all the ministers, Patrick. When they're on the media round in the morning, you wouldn't know half the time that Wes Streeter is a Shadow Health Secretary because he's been asked about Diane Abbott and he's been asked about this story on the front of the Times today. And it's just, they're just sort of noise.
Well, and this also speaks to the government's lack of much of a substantive policy agenda. They aren't really doing anything with the time they have left. Consider how early MPs are knocking off most weekdays now. So it's not as if the policy announcements ministers would otherwise be talking about on Times Radio of a weekday morning are necessarily substantive or interesting ones that would dominate the discussion anyway.
I think Patrick's absolutely bang on here. I think it's a really important point as well. I mean, the fact that so few people are aware of Victoria Atkins, despite health being such an important point, such an important issue, speaks of two things. One, we haven't had an NHS winter crisis, so she hasn't had to stand outside hospitals explaining why they've closed and there's no beds or anything like that. But two, what have the Tories got to say about health at the moment? And I don't know. I mean, I follow politics pretty closely, and I don't have a Scooby what they actually have to say, other than more cash.
So we should probably now give you the full rundown of which politicians the public say they've heard of, including two politicians that don't exist. Here, then, is our full countdown of the Conservative frontbench. At 25, unknown to 55%, is Energy Secretary Claire Coutinho. At 24, made-up Minister Henry Thorpe on 54%. Alistair Jack at 23 with 53%. Tied at 21, Richard Holden and Alex Chalk, both on 52%. A not-so-super group at 17, Lucy Fraser, Mel Stride, Mark Harper and Chris Heaton-Howis, all on 51%, not knowing who they are. At 16, Michelle Donnellan on 50%. At 15, Victoria Atkins, the first known by more than half of voters, on 40%.
48%. At 14, Gillian Keegan on 44%, not knowing who she is. At 13, Laura Trott on 41%. At 12, Deputy PM Oliver Dowden on 38%. And Steve Barclay is at 11 with 37% unsure. Into the top 10 now. And at number 10 is Kemi Badenoch. She wishes with 36%, not knowing who she is. Duetting at 8 on 33%. Esther McVeigh and David Davis, although they probably think that that's former Brexit Secretary David Davis, not the current Welsh Secretary, David T.C. Davis. At 7, James Cleverly on 27%. At 6, Grant Shapps on 24%, not knowing who he is. And into the top 5 now, Penny Mordaunt, 23%, do not know the sword carrier. At 4, Michael Gove on 15% of people not knowing who he is. At 3, the Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, on 9%. The comeback kid, David Cameron, is at 2. 6% of people don't know the former Prime Minister. But at number 1 in our known unknowns countdown is Rishi Sunak, with 4%, 4% of people, so they don't know who the Prime Minister is. There we are. There's your known unknowns of the Tory party. Yeah, Victoria Atkins, right smack bang in the middle of that, Gabriel, which is, was she on 48% of people don't know who the health secretary is. It's amazing, given that waiting list is the one thing that they think.
And is going to be a top three, maybe even a top one issue in the next election campaign.
Okay, so that's in the interest of balance. And due to some production issues, I'm doing this one live. So stand by, everyone. This is my countdown of Labour's shadow cabinet. At 24, Shadow Culture Secretary Thangam Debonair, unknown to 55% of people. At 23, Nick Thomas-Simmons is on 54%. At 22, Shadow Science Secretary Peter Kyle, 53% of people don't know who he is. He's tied with the fake frontbencher Fiona Wilson, who doesn't exist. Just ahead at 20, Shadow Transport Secretary Louise Haig on 52%. A not-so-super group for Labour at 16, with Shadow Business Secretary Jonathan Reynolds, Shadow Environment Secretary Steve Reid, Shadow Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson, and Shadow Chief Secretary of the Treasury Darren Jones, all unknown to 51%. At 13, tied on 50%, Lucy Powell, Shabana Mahmood and Ian Murray. At 11, John Healy and Joe Stevens, unknown to 49% of voters. Into the top 10 now, and at 10, Morning Round regular and Blairite veteran Pat McFadden, unknown to 47% of people. A shock at 9, publicity shy Shadow Health Secretary Wes Streeting, unknown to 44%. At 8, Jonathan Ashworth, who I don't need to tell you is Shadow Paymaster General, unknown to 43%. At 7, Shadow Working Pension Secretary Liz Kendall on 42%. Shadow Foreign Secretary David Lammy at 6 on 34%. Yvette Cooper, the Shadow Home Secretary, and Rachel Reeves, the Shadow Chancellor, tied at 4. 28% of people don't know who they are. At 3, Labour's Deputy Leader Angela Rayner, unknown to 21%. At number 2, another comeback kid, Ed Miliband, unknown to 11% of voters. And at number 1, in our countdown of the opposition frontbench fandom, unknown to 7% of voters, is Keir Starmer. Doesn't that work rather well? Interesting, actually. Looking at that, Gabriel, if people don't know who the health secretary is, Victoria Atkins, and they don't, as a result, you know, because they're not talking about health, does that make it harder then for Wes Streeting, the shadow health secretary, who's also unknown? Given, the media love Wes Streeting, his books and his speeches and his interviews. Do you think it's harder if the government's not talking about health for the opposition to make any running on it?
I don't know. I think it's a very good question, and I'm not sure I know the answer to it at all. I mean, look, you know, I do a lot of polling, but I also talk to ordinary people a lot about politics in focus groups and other things. And it's difficult to overstate the degree of kind of frustration and annoyance that there is around process. and around rhetoric, I think. That's the mood. You know, Britain is grumpy. You know, we're tired, we're skint, we're cold, we're fed up. You know, this has not been a good few years. People are very eager to hear about concrete things that this government or a future government is able to do for them. So I think there is... And Wes, I think, is on the right track on this because, you know, he's developing the policy offer quite, you know, quite substantially and is talking about concrete things that are going to happen as well.
Patrick, in terms of the big six that Gabriel's pointed out, on the Labour side, Keir Starmer, Ed Miliband, Angela Rayner, Rachel Reeves, Yvette Cooper, David Lammy, all known by at least two-thirds of people. That's probably enough, isn't it? An election campaign, they're all quite good media performers. They've been around for quite a long time.
But the question is, are they the media performers Labour will put up during an election campaign? I'm not sure there is direct overlap there. You know, for instance, if you said to some people in Keir Starmer's office, what this general election needs is more Ed Miliband, I think they'd be slightly horrified, although Ed Miliband will be on the airwaves because they see him as credible on the green issues. The person missing there, as you're discussing, are people like Wes Streeting, certainly, Pat McFadden, Bridget Phillipson, less well-known, less favourably regarded, of course, than the legendary Fiona Wilson, people that Labour leadership will lose. But Gabriel, do you think it's a sort of chicken and egg thing? You know, if they're the people who are put up by Labour during an election campaign, they will inevitably become better known when more people are tuning in.
I think we will. And look, let's not forget that, you know, not that recently, although we've all tried to forget about it, you know, we had a Prime Minister, and I tested Liz Truss shortly before she became Prime Minister in focus groups and asked and held up a picture of this woman and said, do you know who this woman is? You know, a majority of people didn't. You know, that was very shortly before she became Prime Minister. She pretty quickly achieved a degree of fame or notoriety, however you want to phrase it. So I think you can do this quickly. One of my colleagues at Portland is, of course, Alistair Campbell, you know, a bit of a master at this sort of thing. And I'm guessing that if Alistair was to be asked, what he'd say is, you've got to get out there and communicate. You've got to work harder and harder and harder. And I think that is the message. On the Ed Miliband point, and on Matt's point as well, a lot of the big six, big seven, are to do with longevity.
Mm.
So, you know, it's Ed Miliband is well known because he's been around a long time. You know, he was leader of the opposition for 5 years. He was a cabinet minister before that.
But he's not hugely liked. 33% unfavourable to
him. He's got really low favourability liking. Yeah, so, yeah. You know, one could say that is, you know, to know Ed Miliband is not necessarily to like him.
And it's true, actually, on the Tory side as well, Salma. So Rishi Sunak and then David Cameron, Jeremy Hunt, Michael Gove, Penny Mordaunt, Grant Shapps, James Cleverly. I mean, at least half of those were there, I think, at the very beginning of the coalition in 2010. Fact that new talent hasn't come through and sort of broken into public consciousness maybe speaks to the endless reshuffles and chopping and changing that, and people have just switched off from the current crop of Tories.
Well, actually, the top list is about longevity. But the people underneath it are even more interesting because, you know, why is Penny Mordaunt famous? What is she known for? Why is Gillian Keegan higher than Vicky Atkins in that list? And it's not necessarily for good things. There are associations in the media for certain things that have been said and, you know, carrying a sword, which everybody got very excited about. So it's not just the fact that you have recognition. It's what is it that you are recognised for? Partly because you've got lots of people who have been around since the coalition, but partly because there's something that's caught the imagination. And it is, unfortunately, in a lot of these circumstances, more about entertainment or negativity than it is about positively making the case for something.
And that's probably true. If you'd polled Jacob Rees-Mogg, I imagine his name recognition would be really high, but you wouldn't necessarily put him at the centre of the Tory election campaign.
No, and you could say the same about Angela Rayner as well, to be honest, you know, who has pretty high recognition, but, you know, doesn't, you know, net out. I think she's quite a polarising figure. I'm a big fan of Angela. I think Westminster needs more people like her, frankly. And I think she has an appeal. And when I, you know, when I run her in focus groups, she does really well with a certain demographic. Very interestingly, she does really well with Tory voters, actually, which is quite interesting. And with women as well, sometimes.
So she's on 27% of favourable, 26% unfavourable, which puts her at a positive one. And you think, well, that's not very high, but when you look at some of the Tories' ratings, they'd bite your hand off for that.
Yeah.
There was a great... It's the story, the write-up of the poll that I did for the Times today. It's currently the most read story on the Times website. There is a quiz. So if you're listening to this and thinking, well, who are these idiots? Somebody messaged in and said, this is proof of why we shouldn't let stupid people vote. You are a fully engaged Times reader, Times subscriber. Go online and do the quiz and see just how well you get on. Ali's been in touch saying Fiona Wilson and Henry Thorpe should have an affair and leak it to the media. I think they should play a key role in our general election coverage. I think we should really leave well,
shall, shall we adopt them?
I think we should adopt them and poll them.
Yeah.
Because the Times...
I think you could... Sorry, Matt, I was just going to say, I think, Gabriel, there's probably something you could do with ChatGPT to bring them back to life.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. To AI bots and see what they see what lines they come up with and see how closely they align to the campaign lines that we hear.
I'm thinking Henry's seat is somewhere rural in Dorset or maybe Norfolk.
Yeah.
Well, sorry to interrupt, but do you remember when the Tory MPs invented an MP called Oliver Cooper, was it? Or something like that, and they... a group of Tory MPs elected in 2019 invented a colleague called Oliver Cooper, I think it was, or something like that. And they said on the WhatsApp group, happy birthday to our colleague Oliver. And several cabinet ministers replied saying happy birthday.
I think Therese Coffey was one of them. Yeah, I'm Therese sure it was. Yeah, yeah. Somebody said happy birthday to Oliver Cooper. I think it was Oliver Cooper. And other people saying happy birthday, have a good day. Oliver Carpenter. There we are. Yeah, if even they don't know. Yeah, I think we should do. I think we should. And it's a good because actually the Times picture desk got AI to generate what Fiona Wilson looks like, and you can see between Yvette Cooper and Angela Rayney. And I genuinely I defy anyone to claim that she's not a real MP. Mm. And actually, several people have pointed out while we're all taking the mick out of the public, not knowing who these people are. During PMQs this week, there was a woman sat behind Rishi Sunak. And it took us the entire length of PMQs to work out it was Felicity Buchan.
Yeah. And, of course, the media have also occasionally made that mistake as well. I mean, one thinks of the taxi driver who ended up on the BBC breakfast sofa.
Guy Geamer. There we are. Get him on as well. Very good. It's lovely to see you all. Let's keep this up. I think we should... If the Tories are going to replace leader, it should be for Henry Thorpe.
Yep. They'll both will figure in our surveys going forward.
Gabriel Millard used to run polling in government, is now at the Portland Communications. Salma Shah, former advisor to Sajid Javid, now at director of Kraken Strategy Limited. And Times Radio senior political correspondent, Patrick McGuire. And do go online to thetimes.co.uk and do the quiz and see if you can pick out the real MPs from the fake ones. Do let us know what you think about that, particularly if you are Fiona Wilson or Henry Thorpe. Get in touch. Email me, matt@times.radio, or WhatsApp me, 0333 003 2353. But for now, from me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.